Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
So here we are. We passed the midpoint of winter.
Yes, the days are getting longer. I'm so excited.
Okay, and so you have these days midweek that are 68 degrees outside.
Yeah, that was a little strange.
It's a horrible tease.
And now it's
why don't you
snowing.
Follow the day with a small snowstorm?
Yeah, that was a little tough.
But what happens is you have that moment, so you're like, oh my God, spring's going to be here.
It's true, yeah.
But in what we do, if you're worried about food, you're worried about wine, you better plan. You plan for seasonal changes, right?
Right. Right. Well, I'm starting to plan my garden, so.
Yeah, that's right. Farmer Wolf is going to be kicking in.
And Farmer Sam, thank God for him.
That would be the professional agricultural.
Yeah, that would be the guy with the degree who actually was on our show one time, which was a lot of fun to have Sam on. We need to have him back on. But he's very articulate. He knows what he's talking about, that man. Thank goodness.
With plants?
Yep.
Yes.
So we were talking about, what did well, because last year was the first year for my garden at my farm, and almost everything did do well. We have a little bit of a groundhog problem.
That's not a problem for the groundhog.
It is for me.
I think you probably have some very, very well-fed groundhogs.
Right? My tomatoes with very large bites out of them. I'm like, dude, just if you're going to bite it, please eat the rest of it.
You're serving a groundhog tasting menu.
Vine. It's like I can see the groundhog in my nightmares on his hind legs, just jumping up, taking one big bite out of everything in my garden.
I'm sure on the groundhog internet, there's all kinds of blogging about the groundhog tasting menu available on your farm.
Well, he better not invite any of his friends because, I'm just not going to say. But anyway.
You're not going to be violent towards
him, are you? We're just going to maybe send him to a new area.
And fence them out?
Yeah. Well, and we did use hoops in the garden, which, I mean, honestly, there was no sign of deer. I don't know if the deer are just dumb and they didn't find my garden or what.
I'm a fool who lives in the city, what are hoops?
Literally just metal hoops. And we put, the beds are 14 feet long. So we had, probably 8 in each bed. And it just keeps the deer from getting in there. They can't physically get in there unless they, remove them somehow, which there was just no sign of the deer in the beds or actually around the beds. It's really weird. I was very fortunate. God knows I'll find them the beds this year. But I'm going to, and the other thing that Sam and I talked about is
I'm going to put like a ranch or something on the edge of your farm for the deer to pick
up. Well, I'm going to have to put up fencing, unfortunately. But we were trying to avoid that more from a visual standpoint than anything. And so the bigger change is going to be that I have 4 14-foot beds, so we're going to add 2, possibly 3 more, which is I'm super excited about. So we can actually, we know everything did very well except for one bean. Every single thing we planted did well.
Everything but one bean.
One type of bean, Tony.
Wow, that's extreme.
Give me a break. But
congratulations. Everything but one bean.
But so we know what we want to plant, and I just need more volume, so we need more space.
Yeah.
So,
I can give you the list of stuff that I wish you were bringing bags of into work.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Number one, cilantro.
Yeah, well, we can use so much of it.
That's what you're not about to plant a bunch of cherry trees, are you?
I'm going to actually plant one cherry tree and a couple of peach trees and definitely, I think, a pear over an apple. I haven't decided, but I'm definitely planting peach trees.
Pears are harder to come by, just in general. That's the market's always tighter on those guys.
I definitely want a cherry tree. I have the room for it, and I have the proper
exposure
for it.
The question is, a sweet cherry or sour cherry?
I would like a sweet cherry.
See, I always want a sour cherry. I guess that's our
dichotomy. Well, thank God it's
dichotomy.
My farm.
Yeah. Thank God.
Thank God I get to make the decision.
Yeah, I'm a sour cherry from the city.
Well, I told you, I had 3 peach trees planted when I lived in Roland Park before I bought the farm. And I mean, I can't believe how well those trees did. Of course, they produced a tremendous amount of fruit.
For the squirrels.
So I look forward to producing a tremendous amount of fruit for the restaurants.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had 3 old fruit trees on the property and we actually just took them down. And they produced very little fruit. They just hadn't.
Spent.
Yes, exactly. And what little fruit there was, it didn't last long. But, we'll get some new trees up. Or what else is on your list of things? You started to say cilantro.
That's always one. But cilantro, arugula. I mean, it seems like every single recipe that I end up having for something. I wish I had a little bit of Calabrian chili for it.
That would be
and
fun.
And I do not know if you can grow them here.
Okay. Well,
because,
let's try it.
You know, soil pHs are particular. And that,
sure.
Lord knows the soil is very different there. But you have reasonable heat and you have a lot of sunshine.
I have a lot of exposure.
So you can grow a lot of kinds of chilies. I'd be curious about that.
Yeah,
sure.
The farm faces north. So, you know, it's the sunlight exposure is really, really fantastic.
Well, here's the thing I was thinking about was, you know, what do you need so you can cook what you want to cook? Is that what you grow, or do you cook what grows well where you are? Because that's always the question, right?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for me, it's my priorities, which I really love working with raw zucchini. So to be able to do the zucchini carpaccio salad that I make, you know, to be able to go out and get the zucchini that morning and prepare it that afternoon, that's what I, you know, so those are the things, those are my goals. I mean, I need to have tomatoes just because I love them so much and I want to have some for my house, quite frankly. Yeah. Now, everything
you don't have such the tomato site.
Right. No, I don't. And the other thing is that obviously, I mean, I can't begin to grow enough tomatoes so for our needs. So the tomato will probably be the only thing in the garden that's really truly just for me. And everything else is going to be for, you know, probably one of the restaurants.
Well, see, ladies and gentlemen, the world is thinking it's February, Valentine's Day is upon us, and we have all of this to do, and we're...
And we've got to get seeds going in the
greenhouse. Food and wine people, so it's like, you're thinking that, and I'm hassling people, and we'll talk about it in the second segment, but I'm hassling people to try to get product for sellers to go with things that we're going to be preparing over the course of the next however many months.
Sure.
That's what the middle of February is, besides trying to provide romantic menus for guests, you know.
Romantic.
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm.
So what is one thing that you, romantic or not, that you expect to be growing this year that you expect to be using in dishes? You said zucchini for carpaccio. What else? What else is the thing that...
Well, the other thing that
you have in your plan.
I absolutely love having squash blossoms. So that's another reason to bring on more beds and have more room, because I love them. And it's just really, truly is just one of my favorite things. So there'll be, I want to have enough plants that I can produce a decent amount of those.
So the squash flowers
and still
have zucchini flowers.
And still have zucchini as well, right. And
so to take us from you clip the zucchini flower from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you take that through a finished dish?
Okay.
Why don't you tease people with a summer dish?
Well,
because this is always like June is the earliest that's going to happen.
Sure. With a squash blossom, for one, the bees rest in there at night, so you really have to be careful when you're working with them.
Yeah, it's a nice surprise when you.
Yeah, there's some other kind of bug. I don't know what
flowers
it's called.
Are closed.
But they also go in there. So you have to be very careful cleaning them. So really, all I mean by that is simply take them off the plant, because they're really pretty clean. They don't sit in the dirt. They sit, you know, on the side of the plant. I don't wash them, actually. And I don't use pesticides. You know, obviously, I'm an organic farmer, so... Well, I'm not a farmer, excuse me. I have an organic garden.
You're a farmer.
I am not a farmer. Let me rephrase that. So...
It's your dirt. You're a farmer.
Well, I'm trying to learn. And it's a big world. The squash blossom is such a great pocket for something to stuff, right? So it is a delicate flavor. After all, it is a flower. So I really, really, really love ricotta with some sort of, maybe some herbs in there, a little bit of fresh thyme or a little bit of basil, tarragon, maybe even chervil. But those have to be in really small quantities.
So it doesn't dominate the flavor of the flour itself.
Right. Or Reggiano cheese. So a little bit of fresh ricotta with a little bit of Reggiano, a little bit of salt and pepper, and an egg. And I put those into a piping bag with no tip. So basically you can buy a plastic disposable bag, or if you have piping bags at home and you just have an opening in the end, you can just fill the piping bag and just shoot that into the squash blossom. But obviously first you've checked to make sure there isn't anything inside of them. And then we do a beignet batter. It's really more of a tempura batter. It's baking powder, baking soda, sparkling water, cake flour, and a little bit of salt and pepper. And you make that batter, and it has to be thick enough, but thin enough. You know, it's something you're going to have to play with a little bit.
Thinner than pancake batter.
I literally don't have a recipe for it. We just make it. It's one of those things we just do. I know Tony's eyebrows are going. And so we dip the stuffed squash blossom in the beignet batter, and we deep fry them in peanut oil. And of course, you can fry them in any oil that you prefer. But I like peanut oil because of the flavor. And they only take about maybe 40 seconds to become nice, golden, crunchy, and absolutely unbelievably delicious.
To sort of ballpark the recipe, so it's more. More cake flour than anything else.
Oh, of course, yeah. So
it's just a pinch of.
Yeah, I would say for 4 cups of cake flour, and you're going to have to play with it, so don't hold me to this, a teaspoon of baking soda, a teaspoon of baking powder, a couple pinches of salt, let's say a teaspoon of salt, and a few twists of a pepper mill, and egg whites.
And all of that dry goods get mixed first, right?
Right, and then you add the sparkling water and the egg whites. So I would say, gosh, I don't know, 4 egg whites.
So an egg white per cup.
Quarter. See, I hate to do this. Right. I really do, but
more or less an egg white.
A little bit of egg white,
and maybe 2 ounces of sparkling water.
That's probably about right. Yeah. You want it to be dippable.
And you mix it, but you're not mixing it like a crazy person.
No, absolutely not. You just barely mix it. You don't whip you just whisk the whites so that they're actually whites, not stringy things.
And then the whisked whites get added.
Mm-hmm.
The water
folded
gets
in, water gets folded,
and everything gets folded together.
Yeah, and you just
and then
keep
you
that
dip
out.
The zucchini flowers.
Right.
Here's a question for you. So when you dip in that batter, zucchini flour, how do you hold the flour so that the stuff you stuffed inside doesn't fall out?
There's a stem on the plant, so you just hold it by the stem.
But then don't the flower petals open up?
No.
Is it magic? Did you wire them together?
No, they don't open up. I've always wondered about that myself until I made them. No, they just hold together.
They just kind of hold?
They just hold together. Yeah. And then the batter immediately forms once it hits the 350. And by the way, you should be at 350 degrees in your fat temperature. But if you did just do ricotta, let's say ricotta reggiano and the egg as a stuffing, or you do goat cheese and egg, reggiano and salt and pepper, I love fresh basil mayonnaise for that. So I would just, one egg yolk for about 3/4 of a cup of corn oil, and that's going to be pretty thick. The juice of 1 lime, and I puree the egg yolk, the lime, and a good amount of basil in the blender, and then drizzle and salt and pepper, and then drizzle in the corn oil to make the mayonnaise. And it's just a beautiful, fragrant mayonnaise for the squash blossom. It's perfect together. And that way you're not putting any herbs in the stuffing.
It's only 4 months away.
Wow, right.
But you got to plant this stuff now.
Yes.
If you want to have it.
To get it going.
So you can enjoy the summer the way that you'd like to.
Well, and Sam put in a cover crop to revitalize the soil. So that did really well. So I'm anxious to see. Well, we've had such a mild winter.
It's been cold a bit, but you haven't been snowed in out there.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also anxious to see if my lavender or if we don't have any more snow, my lavender and my rosemary look good. So I'm hoping that those will live through the winter, and that would be a wonderful thing because I'd like those plants to, and my thyme, I still use it. It's that thyme has proven to be extremely hardy, which is great. I did find a couple of carrots the other day. I was out there. I'm like, oh boy, I miss these guys. Yeah. So.
No, thanks for carrying that recipe all the way through.
Sure.
When you're in the summer and you wish you had a cold bottle of, Cava or Prosecco, or mm-hmm. when it's that rosé, that's the thing that so many people have finally gotten turned on to the last couple of years, some kind of dry, clean rosé. You know, that with a big plate of those zucchini flowers.
It's a treat.
That's a pretty good treat.
Yeah, and getting back to sort of what we're going to plant, we are definitely going to do honeydew or cantaloupe. And actually, Sam and I talked about Charente melon, too. He said they're sort of difficult to grow.
Do you have a dry enough place to grow melons?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had melons this year. I only had one plant, and it had like 10 melons on it. I didn't,
Yeah, Charente are difficult to grow for sure.
Okay, so maybe we'll do cantaloupe or honeydew,
canaries
of beans.
Do well in Maryland.
Okay, 2 different types of beans. For sure the crowder peas, because they did so well. And I'd really like to have fava beans or English peas, if we can grow those. I know that's another reason to have another bed, because we need room for the trellising for the peas. But
Peas come early, and you can follow another crop. You should talk to Sam about
that. Yeah, that would be fun. And lots of herbs. And the lemon verbena did so very well last year. That was so exciting. I absolutely want to make sure that, you know, and he said, you know, possibly those plants, he can work with the plants that we have. So we'll see how that goes. But and then golden beets. And we talked about possibly in the deep bed that we did for root vegetables, having celery in there this year, which would be really fun because I love fresh celery. So
yeah, aromatically, that stuff is so much more powerful than what you typically see.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, lettuces, which did really, really well. I had lettuce all summer. It was really kind of amazing.
Well, you're on a cool site, too. So
yeah, I didn't realize it worked that way. I mean, I never thought I'd have lettuce all summer. That was really wonderful. And we had like 6 different types of lettuces in there. And I mean, that was fun to go out and pick those baby lettuces in the morning and make a salad with those at night. That's just such a treat. So
absolutely.
We'll see.
So when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll see if we can get another recipe out of Chef Cindy Wolf for Summer Expectations as we're doing our planning. And she's going to quiz me a bit on what's going into the cellars and what we're doing to get ready for the warm weather on the beverage side. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy, we're just talking about
my exciting garden plans.
Yeah, that's your...
I can't wait.
Second half of the winter, flipping through seed catalogs, figuring out what to do.
I know, it really is. It's
on
kind
the
of
old
amazing.
Farm.
Well, and how in the world...
Now, have you got boots to go with that?
Yes. Hiking boots.
Hiking boots. Don't you have like big old like muddy waders for...
Oh, no, it's really not necessary.
Okay.
I'm not picking cranberries, Tony.
Okay.
I'm not out in the bogs.
No bogs.
All right. So
I only like cranberries so much, so that's okay.
Oh, I love cranberries. So with the cellar, what are your plans? What's going on there?
Well, one of the reasons we try to travel a little bit in the winter was one, because it makes like in January or February, even March, wine growers don't have that much to do. They've got cellar work to do, but they don't have much to do out of the cellar. So you can really see what's going on. You have a chance to taste.
They have time. They have time for you.
You can taste the harvest from this last year. You can taste the development of the previous one. You have an idea. You can continue to build a picture of what's happening in vintages.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're tasting from barrel and some of the will have been bottled.
Well, and then you're also, honestly, you're going to taste some things in the region. Usually multiple things open on the table at a time, even if you're in a restaurant, for the sake of getting a picture of what's happening.
So really, it's an amazing
thing. You kind of build this matrix of information of what's going on. And they're, you know, just because I can give you a simple timeline of in Piemonte, in Barolo, an area that a lot of people love the wines from, that you're looking at excellent vintages, what looks like a very good 16, what looks like an epic 15.
That's great.
With
good.
Really ripe fruit. 14 seems solid, fine, not special. Maybe 20 years ago it would have been kind of a weaker year, but they know what they're doing a little bit more. 13 seems like a lot like 7. Big, open, sunny, rich. 12s are pretty forward and kind of almost softer, and the alcohol is not quite as high. It's a very, very useful restaurant vintage.
12.
In that you can drink it as a younger wine. That being said, the wines are not going to be the most interesting and the most age-worthy, but this is a sort of important caveat. If you spot a 12 on a restaurant list or on a shelf because you want to drink a Barolo soon, and if it's from a really good crew, like Canubi or Brunate, then buy it and drink it, because it's going to be really delicious as a young wine.
Good.
So that's a very useful year, actually.
Mm-hmm.
11 is pretty big, structured, strong, like 10. 9, a little more alcoholic, open, maybe not so balanced. 8, very classical. So, you know, it's like you have bits and pieces of the picture, but you go there and you get a very good picture. And you can speak in generalities like that about these wines from this area. And those are pretty much all the vintages available in the market right now, one way or another, and the vintage is coming down the pipeline. So it's good to have that. But now, who's done well in what situations, and what particular sites did well, and the crews around what villages did well, you know, that's going to vary a decent amount. So if you actually want to get the very best purchase or the most specifically expressive wine in situation X, you know, you have to actually be in that person's cellar, taste that wine, and sure. see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you learn more about the individual terroirs and what, and with more experience, and I'm no spring chicken, you know, I've been going back and forth a long time to people. I've watched people change in the cellar. Some growers, you know, like in Tuscany, Boscarelli, who I've loved their Vino Nobile del Montepulciano for years and years and years, he's gone through a little more complicated years in 13 and 14. And I think there's some changes in the cellar. So I'm interested to see what exactly happens in 15, which is a great year.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the barrel sample was a little bit strange.
Okay.
From those guys with the 15.
So you mean he's working differently, or?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of brothers there, but I think they're working a little bit differently, or they're handling things in the vineyard a little bit differently. And in the end, it comes down to, like, the humans, like you on your farm.
Sure.
You know, making decisions. About
what
they're going to do and mm-hmm. why they're going to do it. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And sometimes you make those decisions and the decisions are really not in the rhythm of what's going on in nature those years.
Right.
And sometimes they're perfectly. Sometimes you're just lucky and you guess and
sure. Well, you know, and they could have planted new vines, you know, however many years ago. Maybe they're using new stock or something.
Yeah, and sometimes
you get... There's so many variables.
Well, they're oddball things that you find. I mean, that one of the best two or three sparkling wines I've ever had from Italy, I tasted when I was back there in January in Piemonte, the Brolo Peruso Vita. It's something that they don't even sell much. They don't make much of. They don't sell much of. There's a sparkling rosé that's very, very dry
that they produce.
That's from cool. Nebbiolo and Pinot Noir, an odd blend. But, gosh, it's really lovely. And beautiful texture, you know, a reasonable sense of minerality. It's not dominated by any kind of, you know, real tart character, even though it's very, very dry. Great for a lot of the salty antipasti that is served in that area.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how winemakers in certain areas, the wine that they make, as you would expect, makes sense with the food that they eat all the time.
Of course.
You know, so that, and when you're, I mean, for us at different restaurants, or if there's a food, the way that you cook at home, you're going to choose wine that makes sense for those dishes, right?
Right. So basically, we're going to have to move, you know, where I work to Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Chateauneuf-du-Pape is awfully good with a lot of your food.
That's the wine that goes with my food. Hmm.
It's also, I mean, some Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Summer restaurant.
Out. Yeah. Something like that. But, I mean, that's sort of the basic process. And the question then becomes also, what are people interested in? What are they in the mood for? I've referenced in the first segment rosé. People, like 10 years ago, I wanted to buy a lot of rosé and sell it to people for the spring.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't buy it.
And
the retail,
we'd
buy a bunch for the retail store, and they weren't so into it.
Mm-hmm.
But now all of a sudden, maybe it's the whole the metrosexual man thing. Like, everyone's more comfortable somehow now, and pink wine is just fine. And
wine is good to me. Rosé, rosé champagne, rosé, all good.
Yeah, just
it's
just
fun. It's a fun
dry
wine.
Dry rosé, slightly off dry rosé. It is fun. And
it's great with summer food.
Well, it's. There's a lot that's pretty charming for it, and a lot of the reds that don't have tannin, like you think about all the things that you use in food in the summertime, whether it's stronger vegetables or tomatoes or a lot of things towards the end of summer, that a lot of the rosés make a lot of sense, just the way that they're built, the acid that's there. So, but you also, I mean, just like if it's wine for the porch or wine for a picnic, or, you know, you want something cold, refreshing, bright, you know, fruity aromas, fruity character. That's just, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tony, one of the things that I've started to serve that's completely new to me is goat. I've eaten it, but I've never served it. And oh my goodness, it's been very popular. So I want to run that through the summer too. I want to continue to serve it. What do you think about wine for goat dishes? And I'm thinking something along the lines of almost like escabeche. So you have a julienne of green tomato, jalapeno peppers, maybe a poblano pepper,
a little bit of bright fresh relish,
red onion, right, a little cilantro
for goat off the grill, or whether it's like the loin
exactly.
or something like that,
right?
Yeah, I mean that's normal. I mean that's Spain and Argentina are good to look to for, you know, whether it's You don't need that much tannin. Goat is a little bit like lamb with less strong fat, less fat in general, and less strongly right. flavored fat.
Well, and these are baby goats too, so yeah.
Yeah, as you're talking about a 35 to 48 pound animal, most likely.
Yeah, they're really small.
And
it's pretty delicate, and they're tender too. It's so nice.
Yeah,
it's delicious.
Yeah,
super
we get beautiful product. But that's something that you want intensity because it has good flavor, but you don't need much tannin because there's not that much fat. And you need something with some acidity to balance with the, you know, if you talk about putting poblanos in there, well, and my guess is you have acid if it's some kind of a relishy situation that you have going there.
Lime.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, you need, I mean, Tempranillo is a grape, you know, Rioja can do very well, especially for primal cuts like that. And one that has a little bit of bottle age to it would be super. Malbec, yes. Châteauneuf du Pape you mentioned, not giant ones. They don't have to be a 9 or a 7 Châteauneuf du Pape. It could be a year that's a little bit lighter, an 11, or a lot of the 11s right now are really lovely to drink.
So you're talking about bringing wine in. You're only looking for wine that's been recently bottled or things from certain years, or, I mean...
We look for that, and we also look for things that are from... If you have a relationship with a grower and they have things in a library of sorts, I look forward to... There's one grower producer that I have a good relationship with.
You're talking about older wines.
Older wines.
Right.
That's one thing we're always looking for because guests are always excited to find older wines.
Right, right.
You know, in every situation, I'm excited to find older wines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Especially if it's
nice when they'll release some of the things from their libraries.
When it's something that you've had and you've loved and you feel like a big dummy, like I often do, because I already drank it all or I already sold it all.
Right.
And someone has it. And then you're like, look who's not quite as stupid as they thought they were. No, you're not. I'm not any smarter. I'm just luckier. Yeah. You know, that's one of the things I'm looking for. I'm always looking for with growers. I would love to. There's a great grower in Sardinia, De Tori. Mm. I would love to get some things that are a little bit older from him if I can.
That would be exciting, yes.
But it's sort of the devil to get things over time from those guys. But those wines, I want to make sure that there are plenty of as we go into the summer.
Okay.
First and foremost for personal use because they're great. I mean, he is a magician. But that's one of those, like, who are the people that are producing wine for the summer? Clearly Romano, the great producer of Cesenese, the winery not that far from Rome in Lazio, that produces that like punchy, blueberry, but earthy, fruited wine that's great for like bean dishes and like red wine that you actually want for fried things. And, you know, is a great chicken wine, is a great red for warm weather, sitting out on the terrazza, you know, that's also known as your porch.
So back in the day when you first started working in restaurants and you worked at the Governor's Club, would mm-hmm. you have ever thought that you would be meeting with winemakers and getting to be in their cellar and buy directly from them? I mean, it's kind of amazing, the circle for you.
I think...
Because you've always had an interest in wine, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. That's my... My interest in wine comes from my mother dating an older European gentleman who... literally like kept wine around or left wine around so he could have a glass of something he liked. And my first recall of a red wine that I thought was tasty, was weird, but tasty, and I was a little boy. It was 1960 vintage Chateau Latour. And I know, and Jay Miller, who I've tasted with forever, who I met when I was 10, and I know Jay had it because it was. I literally had a little bit when Jay was over.
Wow.
To talk to my mother about my little brother who was having a hard time.
Yeah, which is ironic that you had a relationship that long ago with someone that's so knowledgeable about wine and so involved in the wine world.
Yeah, well, Jay at that point was early in his learning curve.
A psychologist that time.
Yeah, and but I mean, that's, I recall that. It's a little bit like you see a painting when you're a kid and it strikes you and it stays with you. That 60 Latour stayed with me my entire life.
Sure.
And the reason it stuck with me, and I think because of that, when I started to work in restaurants, whether it was in kitchens or in the front, it was always, well, why not? Why can't you do that? Why can't you make something that tastes like that? Why can't you do this? If someone could dream up this dish, or someone could potentially produce that wine, why couldn't you find it or share it or sell it? Or, you know, if it's worth tasting, and well, if I can taste it, if I can tell it's worthwhile, why can't someone else tell it's worthwhile? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's really, it's really from that perspective. I want to find things now, just like I did then, that are cool, that are interesting, that are stimulating. And the fact that I get to share them with people, you know, it's if I didn't do that, I'd have a job, you know.
Exactly. It is a beautiful part of what we get to do.
But, I mean, that's from when I was a little kid, it never occurred to me to do anything else besides, well, wait, what's better than finding cool stuff and sharing it? Huh? And that maybe that's music for you. Maybe that's a solution to a particular problem, you know, whether it's engineering or mathematical or, you know, a marketing, like there's a million things that are fun to fix, but the sort of why not attitude, I think I always had that because certain things struck me when I was a kid, like that 60 La Tour, which yeah. I could tell you was incredibly vivid. I mean, I did not even know it was walnuts I was smelling because I'd not really consciously tasted walnuts. And when I tasted walnuts probably like 2 years later, they were really fresh and I smelled them when they cracked. It reminded me immediately of having tasted that particular wine. And I went down in the basement of the house to see if there was any more of that wine.
Wow.
I will admit. Just so I could try to talk my mother into opening a bottle. But it had long gone.
I'm sure.
I don't think that 60 Chateau Latour was priced out the same as 2016 Chateau Latour is. Anyway, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, I'm going to bother Cindy Wolf for maybe a dish or two for two, as Valentine's Day is coming up.
I would like that.
And then we have a chef's challenge coming, don't we?
Yes.
All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Here's the big question.
What's that?
Besides all the planning for the seasons upcoming,
mm-hmm.
It's Valentine's Day this week.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of Chateaubriand because it's such a great piece of meat.
See, some people think of like chocolates and flowers and dresses, and Cindy Wolf, ladies and gentlemen, thinks of a great piece of meat. Please go ahead.
Well, I was bored to be a chef. Okay, so Chateaubriand is the center cut of the beef tenderloin. So at the top end of the tenderloin, you have three muscles. It's quite obvious that there are three muscles up there. At the other end, it's kind of a tail. We call it the tail end. It's thin. So 3/4 of that middle part, that's the Chateaubriand. And not everybody knows that. So sometimes people call other things Chateaubriand, but it really does denote basically the center best
it's
portion
not the
of the tenderloin.
Tenderloin.
Right. And so it's kind of awesome to, it's such a beautiful piece of meat. And if you don't buy a really large tenderloin, you want it something, if you are buying a, ask the butcher for 5 pounds and down, which is a small tenderloin. If you're trying to do this for two people, you're still going to be left with other, more meat to do things with, which you could make steak tartare. If you really want to have a lot of meat courses,
you can
have a little steak tartare. What's that?
Get an Uruguayan tenderloin and they're all small.
Okay. All right. And so with Chateaubriand, you want to cut those two sections off and then just rub it with corn oil, salt, and pepper, or anything else that you like. But
you're talking about
honestly,
cutting the entire piece. You're not cutting into steaks.
As this whole piece.
Or tornadoes.
Right. And so you can either roll it around in a hot saute pan, heavy bottomed, you know, great pan, high heat, corn oil. Brown it on all surfaces, and then pop it in the oven and roast it to whatever temperature you like. Or you could grill it. And honestly, if you could wood smoke, and again, because our temperatures have been pretty mild at times, if you feel like going outside and wood, you know, grilling it, that smoke would make it really wonderful. Also, the other thing I have done is once I've seared it, I've wrapped it in bacon. So if that is your thing, it is really, really good. And because the beef tenderloin, it's sort of like the same thing as the French idea of larding, which is adding fat to a piece of meat in order, a lean piece of meat, in order for it to roast well, and to have some moisture in it
well,
as
bacon,
it's roasting.
Bacon also has a particular flavor that.
Well, and that's it. Now you need to be careful with the kind of bacon you use. You want to use a neutral bacon. You don't want to get something that's super salty or extremely smoked
or sweet.
Or oh gosh, that would be awful. Or
well,
sweet.
A lot
I never
of
even think of bacon as being
a lot
sweet.
Of the Applewood smoked
choices.
Pieces are sweet. Yeah.
You're right. So a good neutral bacon and nice. Pretty thick strips. Don't buy the thin pieces because they have them all different, sliced all different ways now.
Ah, thin pieces.
Yeah, exactly. So wrap it, tie it with string. That'll hold that bacon on there for you. And you've already seared it or grilled it. You need to mark the outside, caramelize the outside of the meat, and then put the bacon on, tie it on, and you can roast it or grill it that way. And grilling, it's going to be a bit of a mess because you're going to have flare-ups on your grill with bacon. If you're going into an oven, I suggest doing the bacon or not. And then you have this amazing piece of meat that, of course, has to rest before you're ready to slice it. And I was thinking sort of traditional that I could quickly tell you how to make sauce hollandaise, which is, you know, I'm sorry, it's just one of the very best sauces for beef tenderloin. There's no question.
If you tell, people, if you tell people to make hollandaise or béarnaise, you can have someone in their kitchen on Valentine's very dressed up cursing you. But go ahead, please.
Okay, so you can't break the sauce. So try it the day before for breakfast and have poached eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an expensive product. Play around with it. Make it five times before Valentine's Day. I mean, all it is butter, eggs, and I use lemon juice and Tabasco and salt, which is not the traditional way to make it, but you can make it this way. So you need a double boiler, which is a bowl over a pot that has a little bit of water or a decent amount of water in the bottom of it, creating a steam hitting the bottom of that bowl. So your pot is on the stove on low heat with water in it. Let's say a quarter of the pot is full of water. You put a bowl in and you whisk, it's 6 yolks per pound of butter. You don't need a pound of butter for two people. So let's say you're doing, let's say even half a pound. So 8 ounces of butter, that would be 3 yolks. So 3 yolks in the pot, in the bowl. Whisk it with salt, fresh lemon juice, and Tabasco, the juice of half of a lemon. I would say at this point, 2 drops of Tabasco. And maybe a teaspoon of salt. You need to whisk that over that double boiler to work the egg yolk, to begin to cook it. You are looking to aerate the egg yolk. This helps with the thickness of the sauce. So you actually are whisking the yolk to create some thickness. Meanwhile, you have whole butter on the stove, and I use whole butter. Traditionally, you would use clarified, which means that the milk solids have been removed. But I use whole butter because I prefer the flavor of whole butter. And you will not use all of the milk solids because that will thin out your hollandaise. That's one of the reasons why you're not supposed to use whole butter. But your butter should be warm on the side, on the stove, heat off, melted, warm.
So how do you remove some of the milk solids?
You just don't use all the milk solids from the bottom
people
of the
know
pot.
The white,
creamy, foamy, weird stuff that doesn't look like fat, yellow fat, that's milk solids. So that will fall to the bottom of the pot. So if you're gentle with removing the fat from the top at first, and then as you see your hollandaise begin to thicken, then you know you can start to add a little bit of the milk solid as well. But that needs to be warm going into the warm egg yolks. And the biggest thing is a very gentle, steady stream. Literally, it's not drops of butter that you're adding, but it's a very tiny stream because the egg yolk can only absorb so much fat, which is what butter is, at a time. And you must whisk the entire time you're adding the butter to the egg yolks. And as it thickens up and you use most of that we use all the fat of the butter up and a little bit of the milk solids, it should be good. You can always adjust it with a tiny bit more lemon juice if you feel like you need it. But it's not about it tasting like lemon. It just helps to add balance to the fact that you're working with something that's protein and fat. And you need a little bit of balance for those things, the protein, of course, being the egg yolk, the fat being the butter, in the form of the lemon juice. And the Tabasco just gives a little kick. So again, that should be very delicate.
Just seasoning.
Yeah, just seasoning. It's like using
salt.
Pepper, but not. I put a pinch of salt in. You absolutely need salt. And I do work with unsalted butter. So if you like to work with unsalted butter, you will want to add a little pinch of salt. And then that is made right before you're serving the beef. You could probably hold it in a warm spot on the back of your stove, but it's very volatile. So it's just best to make it and serve it. And the other thing I was thinking, if you're really up to cooking is to make sauce bordelaise. And that's getting marrow from your butcher and using a good a Bordeaux, good red wine, reducing it down with a little bit of shallot, maybe one bay leaf. And let's say you are doing 4 cups of reduced stock, that sauce consistency stock, adding the red wine, reducing it down, a little bit of shallot. Once that's good and ready and flavored, go ahead and strain it, and then add the whisk and the marrow, and it is a beautiful, beautiful sauce. Highly shiny, which is a high-quality sauce, and also the flavor that you get from the beef marrow is delicious. And then whatever your favorite vegetable is. Maybe it's cauliflower, maybe it's haricot vert, maybe it's wilted baby spinach, which would also be good with the hollandaise. Broccoli, which would be great with the hollandaise. Any sort of vegetable to accompany that. But that's just a fun little dish to do for two.
Very good. Well, you ready for Chef's Challenge?
I am.
Now that you've
made dinner for two. Whole duck, barley, white beans, bay scallops, pink grapefruit, garlic, I love. Garlic, carrots, Tuscan kale, brown chicken stock, celery root. Wow, this is a lot of ingredients, Tony. Rosemary,
sometimes
ginger.
Sometimes you say I don't give you enough ingredients.
2 bottles of chenol. Ooh. Dairy, extra virgin olive oil, spice cabinet, mangoes. And what was the second thing? It looks like it says Canadian bark bacon.
Canadian? Yes, it's Canadian bark bacon.
What is it?
It's on the back of the pig. Canadian
back
bacon.
Bacon.
Canadian back,
back bacon.
Bacon.
Oh, God,
bark bacon. Yes.
Duck. Barley.
Yes, it's actually okay. Canadian chocolate bark with bacon.
I've never even cooked
bacon.
Barley before. Where do you come up with these things? Barley.
From the earth. They grow them in the earth.
All right. Bay scallops, I'm going to get a pan on. Bay scallops are the smallest of the scallops, and I love bay scallops.
I'm looking for...
Stop talking.
2 courses.
Pink grapefruits. Oh, are you?
I'm looking for 2 courses.
Yes. Pink grapefruits, I'm going to cut off the outside of the grapefruit, make sure all the white, the pith is gone, and then do supremes, which is you go in and out, basically. You're taking the meat of the grapefruit out without any of the other parts that you don't like. I'm going to have that. I'm going to butter poach the garlic. I'm going to make a carrot puree. I was just talking to Luke about carrot puree, so I'm going to do that. I cook the carrots in a little bit of water, salt, sugar, and just a touch of orange juice in the water. Once they're soft, pass them through a small fine grate on a food mill so that they actually still have some texture. I'm going to mix that. Actually, you know what? I'm going to do the same thing with the celery root. I'm going to mix the carrots and the celery root together. That way, the celery root will have to be cooked a very long time to go through a food mill because it's kind of woody in texture, but it can be done. And actually, I may pass both the carrots and the celery root through the food mill at the same time. Now I'm going to season them with the same thing I cooked them in. So I'm going to add a little bit of orange juice to the carrots and the celery root, a tiny bit of sugar, salt and pepper, butter, and a tiny bit of cream. And I'm going to plate. I'm going to saute those bay scallops, get them nice and brown. It will take all of about 2 to 3 minutes in a hot pan. And I'm going to put the carrot and celery root puree. Actually, there could have been a little ginger in there, too. So you've given me ginger. I'll add that
to that
puree. You have.
I give you many ingredients.
Meanwhile, I'll be drinking the 2 bottles of chenol.
You will.
Uh-huh. All by myself.
I would be.
I love chenol.
Good luck with cooking the scallops to tempt them.
You know I don't drink when I'm cooking. But I'll have a glass of the chenol since I'm cooking at home. And that will be served with the amazing duck course that is going to happen with some barley somehow. But anyway, back to that scallop. The grapefruit supremes will garnish the puree in the center of the plate. And that's the first course. The duck, I have white beans, so I'm definitely cooking the white beans with a little bit of the Canadian bacon. I'm going to put the barley into the pot at the end of the cooking process of the white beans so that it becomes soft. And now I have barley and white beans together. I'm going to reserve some of that. Well, I never use the garlic. So the garlic is butter poached and goes into the beans as they're cooking. And what will be really fun... and I'm cooking them all
porridge.
In that chicken stock. Yeah, pretty much. Actually, it's going to be more like a broth with barley and white beans in it and garlic. And at the end, I'm going to wash the Tuscan kale really, really well. I'm going to take the stem out, stack it, julienne it or chiffonade it, whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to add that to the beans, the bacon, and the barley at the end. Meanwhile, I am roasting my duck. And then I'm going to have the duck on the table. and it's going to be sliced in front of the guests, and I'll have a big, beautiful tureen with the broth in it, and we will be eating the first course.
You did exactly what I would have wanted to do with all those goodies. Okay. Just nice big pieces of crispy duck and all broken down.
Everyone, okay. Look out for Canadian back bacon, please.
Yeah. Also, the Canadian bark bacon is really trending right now. It's a popular item.
It's
really trending. I think you've left me a little bit of time. Sea scallops.
Oh, that's funny. We're so weird.
Barco ham.
I can't believe we picked the same product, but mine are seas.
Sea scallops are, I mean, the scallops are in
season.
I
love scallops.
So it's like one of those pain in the butt to get in the wintertime, but they're actually in season.
They're really good.
Barco ham, lemon, extra virgin olive oil, herbs, Yukon gold potato, baby golden beets, pork tenderloin. Don't ever cook pork tenderloin.
I know, and I don't
collard
either,
greens,
actually.
Collard greens, rice, stock, slab bacon, butter, shallots, garlic, onion. All right. The pork tenderloin I want to stuff. I want to stuff with the Iberico and some of the collards that have cooked off for a long while in the onion with stock. And a little bit of no bacon necessary. And herbs, really kind of depends on the herbs, but they would need to be strong ones. It's almost more spices than I'm after for that. Maybe a little bit of cumin. But I would want to stuff that guy. And sear it off very well. And slice it. Chill it. And then slice it thin.
You're serving it cold?
I'm serving it cold. I want to make a salad with the rice. With the rice and garlic. And baby golden beets, and lots of fresh herbs, and a little bit of lemon. I'm thinking about the weird warm days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to have like the weird warm winter day where I can have lunch on the porch.
You know, that'd be nice.
I want to have that. The sea scallops I want to have as a main course, and I want to have the sea scallops, a little piece of crispy bacon on them. The Yukon gold potatoes I'm going to cook in very salted water, and as they while they still have the skins on and they're cooling down, I'm going to slice them nice and fat. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lay a sea scallop on that and a piece of crispy bacon.
There you go.
I'm going to dress it with a little bit of herb oil. I'd like to, if God blessed me with marjoram, it would be marjoram oil mm-hmm. with the extra virgin olive oil and a tiny little bit of garlic in that. And then I would dress that with the butter I have not used, the beets I have not used. I guess I'm going to cook the beets and the butter.
Okay.
And just do that as a little side dish.
Actually, that's the other thing that didn't do well on my
lots
garden.
Lots of fresh chives.
Marjoram. I need to try marjoram again this year. Okay.
Marjoram's tough.
All right.
I think I used everything that she gave me. Yeah, but I want like that cold course and then,
mm-hmm.
and then
what are you drinking with
the main
that?
Course. Oh, gosh. It could be rosé, but that's a little bit of a push. Maybe more Chenin Blanc of some sort. Okay. Maybe a nice fat Vouvray, slightly off dry. Maybe make the pork tenderloin a little bit spicy, perhaps. But yeah, I think that's that. Well, I think that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
The producer and the engineer that we almost never mention is Luke Spignall on this program, who actually makes everything work.
We love him.
He's pretty dandy. if you do wish to contact us via email, tell us what's going on in your planning for your garden or what you're going to be doing in your cellar, it's foremanwolf@wipr.org. If you want to download this or any other podcast, go to the site, wipr.org, and look up the Foreman Wolf homepage. If you want to follow me on social media, it's The Real Tony Foreman on Instagram. And to follow Chef Cindy Wolf.
On Instagram, it's Chef Wolf. On Twitter, it's Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we hope you have a great Sunday.
And happy Valentine's.